All right, so we are at the end of Perek Zayin, the end of chapter 7, up to Psukim Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet, sentences 13 and 14. Remember, Shmuel held his big reform in the beginning of the chapter, and the Jewish people are ready to follow Hashem. We talked about what that looks like and the sort of utopian vision. We saw that when the people gathered together, even though it was for a religious purpose in service of Hashem, the Plishtim see us gathering, and they think it must be military. And so they attack, and Shmuel davens to Hashem, and Hashem responds. Remember, Shmuel brought a korban. We talked about the symbolism of this tzlei chalav, this young sheep. And Hashem aids them, thundering against the Plishtim. We noted the echoing of Chana's thundering in her tefillah and Chana's request that God should also thunder against the enemy, going back to the Perek Bet. And we're up to the last few sentences here. So take a look at Psukim Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet, 13 and 14. And thank you, TK, for hosting this week. Vayikanu haplishtim. So not only do we win, but the Plishtim are humble. V'lo yasfu od labo b'gvul Yisrael. No longer do they invade our territory. Now, technically speaking, that's not quite true, because our territory included the cities that they were living in. What it means is the area where Jews lived. But the he yad Hashem b'plishtim kol yimei Shmuel. Hashem's hand was upon the Plishtim all through Shmuel's career. V'atashovna he'arim asher lakhu plishtim me'ez Yisrael li'Yisrael, and the cities that the Plishtim had taken from us came back to us. Ekron, Gad, Gvulon, all of these Hashem saved from the Plishtim, and there was peace between Israel and the Amori. And we noted last time that we need to ask, who asked about the Amori? Why are the Amori listed here? This is all about the Plishtim, who threw in the Amori. But there's also one other problem. You say that the Plishtim didn't cause us any trouble, kol yimei Shmuel. Is that true? One of the most famous stories in Shmuel involves a Plishti warrior.
Yeah, Goliath.
Right. Goliath. That story of Goliath, occurs when the Plishtim are indeed at war with us, and Shmuel is very much alive. So how can you tell me that the Plishtim didn't attack us all the days of Shmuel? How do you make sense of this? This is just a minor point. Really, we just have a few things to wrap up in this Perek. Perek Ches is going to be where the action is. But take a look on your sheet, please, at source number one. Radak explains. He says, it wasn't that as long as Shmuel was alive, we had magical protection from the Plishtim. It was as long as Shmuel was being Shmuel. Ad asher zakan Shmuel, until Shmuel aged. V'lo yachol atzeis v'lavo lifneihem, he could not lead them. Ulesavev al areihem, and circulate in their cities. Ulehochicham kmo sha'asa lifnei ziknaso, and to rebuke them, and to educate them, and to instruct them as he had before he aged. And therefore the Jews indeed sinned, and the Plishtim attacked them. And that's why they end up asking for a king, which is what we have to talk about in the next parak. But the idea is, while he was still being Shmuel, we were protected. Once Shmuel is no longer able to function in that way, and the people fall back into what they had been like before, that's when we get into trouble, and the Plishtim attack. As far as the Amori, so the answer likely is what Radak says here. There are a couple of answers, but one answer is what Radak says. Malbim says it as well. Lo yadati tam l'sipur hazeh b'zeh, or l'sipur, no, l'sipur hazeh b'zeh ha'makom. He says, I don't know why this is mentioned here about the Amori. Ki lo ra'inu b'zmanu milchama bein Yisrael u'bein ha'amori, alein plishtim. There was no war with the Amori at this point. It's not like something stopped that had been going on. So he says, El ulai biyos haplishtim nechamim b'Yisrael, hayu nechamim b'hem gam kein yeser ha'amori, shenishru ba'aretz im b'nei don. He says, it's possible that since the Plishtim were battling us, so also the rest of the Amori fought with Dan. at the same time. The so the Plishtim are fighting with us on one side, and the Amori are fighting potentially on the same side or on the other. And the reason I say same side or the other is because Dun lives in two places. Dun is down by the Plishtim on the one hand, and then they also have this other land that they take that we read about at the end of Shoftim up in the north. So the question is which land we're actually referring to here. The Amori tended to be closer to the Yarden. But he suggests fundamentally there's an alliance between the Plishtim and the Amori, and that's why it's mentioned here. Alternatively, you could answer, as Ralbag does, that it's simply saying not only did we have peace with the Plishtim, but this is the utopia. Everybody is afraid to attack us, including the Amori. Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. No, thanks, but we did. Okay, yeah.
If Shmuel really died at
852, yes.
Why is he saying that he was old?
Go back to the discussion that we had before about the question of the chronology, and we had said that the Navi says explicitly that he is Zakein. Abarbanel used that as an argument to say that he does not die at the age of 52, but the alternative approach, which was what the Gemara had said, was that Hashem prematurely ages Shmuel, lest people think that he was taken young as a punishment. They'll view it as simply physical deterioration, and that some people just age faster than others. So those were our two approaches. Okay, wrapping up the parak, the last three sentences. Vayishpot Shmuel is Yisrael kol yimei chayav. Shmuel judged Israel all through his life. V'halach midei shana b'shana. And he went every year. V'savav Beit El v'ha-Gilgal v'ha-Mitzpah. He made a circuit. He went to Beit El. He went to Gilgal. He went to Mitzpah. These are all areas that are just north of Yerushalayim. Gilgal is closer to the Yarden. Beit El, you may recall, is the first place where Abraham and Sarah camp when they come into the land. So clearly also when you come in from the east, you get there. Mitzpah is, of course, an area that we've been talking about a lot. V'shafates Yisrael, eis kol mekamos ha'ela, and he would judge Israel in all of these places. In other words, he was a circuit judge. He didn't sit in his court and say, everybody has come to me, but he's willing to circulate, which is very consistent with Shmuel's personality. Right? We've seen him to be someone who puts himself at the disposal of the nation. Uz shuvaso haramasa kisham beso. And then he would go back to Ramah. That was where home was, right? Shmuel of Ramah. That goes all the way back to the beginning of the Sefer. Visham shafat es Yisrael, and he judged Israel there. Vayiben sham mizbeach Lashem, and he built an altar for God there. Is there anything odd here? Anything unusual in this?
Why did he build another altar?
Yeah. So we know, because we already read about it from his previous altar, that they were allowed to have private altars at this point. The Mishkan of Shiloh is now destroyed, so it's permissible. And I think what he's trying to do is to maintain their call to Hashem, this reform that he started with Karbanot. You know, he wants to maximize their connection with God. It's a good question. I think that's probably the answer. But here's something that's interesting. First of all, we stress kol yimei chayav, all his life. Why would I have thought otherwise? What is it trying to tell me?
He didn't take a break. He didn't retire.
He didn't have a retirement. Could be. What happens at the end of Shmuel's life? Besides his death. But before that.
Shaul dies.
That's not even a funny joke. What?
Shaul dies.
Well, Shaul dies after Shmuel.
Oh, after.
Yeah, that was part of his whole premature death thing.
He anointed David.
He anointed David, and before he anointed David, he anointed Shaul. In other words, Shmuel doesn't stop, even though there are kings.
But the king wasn't necessarily a judge. He was just a king.
But this is going to be a really, really important point. Keep that thought in mind, because we're going to have a discussion about the different roles of Shofet and Melech as we start Parakhet, the next chapter, which is going to introduce the request for a king. What is the distribution of powers? Right? I come from a country where you have an executive And then you have a legislature who make the laws, and then you have a judiciary that's supposed to make sure that the laws actually fit the constitution of the country. All jokes about government are not relevant here. We're talking about what's supposed to be. You have a division of authority in order to make sure that no one branch is able to ride roughshod over the others. So what exactly is going on here? Is there a duplication? Is there a separation of powers? How does this work? And why is it important to us that Shmuel is going to continue to be a shofet, even though there is a melech? It's going to matter a great deal.
And does it continue after Shmuel?
And what will happen to this role exactly after Shmuel is done?
Navi start, is only a navi, or
right? So that's part of what we'll have to discuss as well. Good. Another note I want to call your attention to. V'haya midei shana b'shana. Does that turn of phrase remind us of anything?
Yeah.
What does it remind us of?
Elkanah
and Chana. Right? How they used to go to the Mishkan every year. So children hopefully learn something from their parents. So he also has an annual cycle that he is doing Lishma as his avoda. That's his service. His parents did it, and he draws from them. Also worth noting, Radak notes this. It says that he would go to Rama, right? The Kisham Beito, because that's where his house was. So Radak says the simple meaning of because that's where his house was is he had a root, Mitzpah, Beit El, whatever, Gilgal, and if you lived near those places, then that's where you went to get judged. But what if you weren't on the route, then you came to his home in Ramah. That was where you would go to be judged. By the way, you know Ramot. That's Ramah. That's the usual understanding, because a lot of discussion goes on about Ramot in terms of Purim and whether they celebrate Shushan Purim or whatever, which day they celebrate, and some of the proofs to it go back to Shmuel and Ramah. But Radak says the simple read is Sham Beito means in Ramah is his house, and therefore you go to Ramah if you need to get judged and you're not on his circuit. But take a look at the Gemara in Brachos, which offers another idea. Harotzeh lehenot yehenek ke'elisha. One who serves the community and wants to also benefit from doing so should benefit as Elisha did, which is to say, minimally. Elisha doesn't take what's offered to him, like from Naaman. Elisha benefits minimally. V'she'ena rotzeh lehenot, but if he doesn't want to benefit, al yehene, so don't benefit. Kishmuel haramati, just like Shmuel. You want to benefit, you have a model. Elisha is your model. However, if you don't want to, you have Shmuel as your model. What do you mean? Shenemar, the pasuk says, Uchuvasau haramasa kisham beiso. Literally, he would return to Ramah. His house was there. But Rabbi Yochanan said, no. Shekol makom shahalach sham beiso imo. Wherever he went, his house was with him. In other words, he didn't stay in people's houses. He brought his own stuff. He camped out. And that was the way he took care of himself. Shmuel refused to benefit from the people he was serving. He liked camping. He would camp out instead. Yes.
Is Elisha the one that was the Navi after
Eliyahu?
Eliyahu, is that the one they're talking about?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Okay. Good. So that wraps up what we talked about last week with Perek Zayin. I'm going to start a new recording for Perek Chet.